It's time for Gervie's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervie. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan Gervie and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. And now, here's your host, Alan Gervie.
Good evening, Los Angeles, and everyone listening on KBC.com around the world. I am Alan Gervie, the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan Gervie and Wynn, and tonight, as usual, I'm here to be the managing partner of your life, but I don't do a very good job of that, so I've invited someone who is so much more capable of managing your life than I am, because she's had so many careers. This is a really incredible person. It's tough enough being a lawyer, as I can tell you, but how are you a successful actress and a lawyer? We are going to find out, because guest hosting with me today is none other than Lauren Woodland. Lauren, welcome to Gervie's Law.
Well, thank you so much. Happy to be here.
It's great to have you. Wow. I'm not the only one who's happy to have you here. Our huge studio audience is really excited about it. And now, for those of you who don't know Lauren, she has had a life of acting. She's been on so many TV shows and in TV series, and she's been in a lot of commercials, but she's really well known for The Young and the Restless. She's had an Emmy nomination, and she was in Alien Nation, the movie and the TV series, the TV movie, TV series. And interestingly, Lauren, after all of that, you went and really, really smart. You went to UCLA Law, USC undergraduate, and you were also at Tisch at NYU. And it's funny because my wife started at USC and then transferred to Tisch. You did the opposite.
Wow. Yeah, I did. I wanted to go to the musical theater program there at Tisch, and I thought living in New York City was going to be this incredible experience. And it's an incredible town, but at 17, I wasn't ready to live there and start college on my own. So I transferred to USC, and I ended up majoring in history.
Wow. But what about the acting? How are you able to juggle the acting, the academics, and then, of course, the law?
Well, I've been practicing that it is a juggling game, and I've been practicing that all my life. I started acting in Tucson, Arizona, when I was about 6 years old, because the production companies who do commercials from L.A. would come to Arizona because there weren't strong labor laws there for children.
Right.
So I was in an acting class that my mom had put me into that I enjoyed, and the guy that ran the acting class moonlighted as a local agent. So I started auditioning for commercials, and I booked them, and there was a director from L.A. who said to my mom, you know, if she goes out to L.A., she'll work all the time. So we ended up.
And it's true.
Yeah.
It was true. You know, it's funny because a friend of mine, Neil Patrick Harris, who was from Albuquerque, New Mexico, has the same story. He was just, you know, doing some acting there, and then Whoopi Goldberg saw him and wanted him in Clara's Heart, which he started. But he came to L.A., and you were the same in Arizona, New Mexico, and things are really different once you get here.
Oh, yeah. We all of us child actors end up coming to L.A. from some other state usually.
Right, right. And then, of course, you did The Young and the Restless, and you went back to The Young and the Restless just recently, being at Novian and Novian in Century City, where you are an attorney and you are you practice entertainment and intellectual property, business litigation, employment litigation, sexual harassment, discrimination, wrongful termination, real estate litigation, all of that stuff. And then in 2019 and 20, you're back on Young and the Restless. How did that happen?
Good question. Yes. Well, I'd always wanted to be an attorney, but I'd acted my whole life. And after college, I didn't want to apply to law school right away, and I was having a very good acting career. So I had this opportunity for this role, Brittany Hodges on Young and the Restless. And when I got the breakdown, I just thought, wow, you know, this is me. Nobody can play this better than me. And you almost never get an opportunity like that.
Right.
So I just really wanted the part very badly. And I ended up getting it. And I was on the show for almost 6 years, and I absolutely loved it.
Were you taping at NBC in Burbank?
CBS Television City.
Oh, CBS
Fairfax
Television.
And okay. Beverly. Yeah, which is so much fun because it has so much history.
Yeah, and, it's amazing.
You know, it's incredible. The Price is Right is right, next door. The Wheel is there in the hallway.
And you were there for like every day for 6 years?
Pretty much,
not
yeah. Well, I would say you average probably about 2 to 3 days a week. It's an incredible job for an actor.
So how did you have that kind of presence of mind to say, okay, I want to be a lawyer?
Well, being a lawyer, it was always in the back of my mind, but I wasn't going to leave acting to become a lawyer. I was going to stay on The Young and the Restless. And if I wasn't going to be on Young and the Restless, my plan was to be on some other soap opera. Because I had done primetime my whole childhood. Never did soaps. And primetime is very different. It's a different way of working. You're traveling a lot. You're always on location. You have a hiatus. You don't work year-round. And the shows end. You know, they maybe last 5 years. A soap opera lasts for 30 years, you know, and there have been people, you know, there are people on soap operas right now who have been on for 30 years. So I thought, when I got into daytime, I thought, wow, this is incredible because it's the closest thing to a 9-to-5 job you could have.
Right.
You go to the same studio every day. You're not constantly on location. You play the same character and you get to grow with the character.
Yeah.
And you work with the same actors. And
it's kind of like being at a law firm.
It's as close as you can get to having a normal, quote, normal, regular job.
Yeah.
And I always wanted that stability as well.
Right.
And but at the time, I had 2 3-year contracts. And then the show changed ownership and changed control. And there were new people who came in and wanted to change things up. So I didn't, I was very disappointed and surprised when I didn't get another contract because I just figured I would just keep doing what I do on that show. And so I thought, well, you know, maybe I'll try to get on another soap because that was very normal to move from soap to soap. But at that time, this was around the end of 2005, everything started to really change in daytime television, especially soaps. They were just not as popular as they once were, and they were starting to go off the air. And that sort of opportunity just sort of shrank, and I could see the writing on the wall that soaps were not going to be here for much longer. And in fact, now there's only 3 soaps on TV.
I didn't realize that. Wow.
Yeah.
I got to start watching daytime TV.
And there are no soaps. Oh, it's great.
I work for a living. And you do, too.
Yeah.
And we've got some work to do because we have Dan Abrams coming up after. And we're going to talk more to Lauren Woodland later in the show. But we got to talk to Dan Abrams. Lots going on in his life. You got to hear all of the projects that are happening with Dan Abrams right after the break. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC. Yeah, I'm just going to listen to the music. Sounds a little like Green Day. You know, I got tickets to Green Day on September 3rd at Dodger Stadium. I had 2 front row tickets because I never miss a Green Day show. And then my wife said to me, what about taking the kids? And that was my dream, to take my kids to a Green Day show. They're 7 and 8 years old. And at 7 and 8, they're going to experience their first Green Day show. Hopefully it comes off because this is from last year. But don't be playing Green Day and think you're going to slip it by me, Art. My best one was at the Palladium, by the way, again, in the mosh pit, Green Day. I'm too old for that, but my kids are going to carry on my legacy, just like our next guest, whose father has been on the show a couple of times, and he is carrying on the legacy of Floyd Abrams, who is still an amazing guy. If you listen to the podcast of the Dan Abrams podcast, you'll hear his father a few weeks ago talking about Trump and Facebook and all kinds of stuff. And Floyd Abrams was on with Christiane Amanpour about a year and a half ago, I think. And then he came to talk about the Masterpiece case on our show. But we're not going to talk about Floyd. We're going to talk about Dan, because Dan is, in his own right, one of the most important media people in law, marrying law and media. He's the host of the Dan Abrams Show on Sirius XM, POTUS Channel. great show to listen to. We had Michael Smirkanish on not too long ago from SiriusXM, ABC News chief legal correspondent, was the host of Live PD on A&E, and everyone loved that show. Former anchor of Nightline, legal correspondent, analyst for NBC News. He anchored MSNBC News, and he hosted his 9 p.m. Live with Dan Abrams show, was an anchor on the Today Show, Good Morning America show. All right, Dan, enough. You know what? Yeah. And this week, you steal all the headlines. This week on The View, talking about how Trump is going to be indicted, in your humble opinion. But I don't even want to talk about that. Let's talk to Dan Abrams about all the exciting things going on with him. Not about Trump. We don't need to talk about him. We can talk about Kennedy's Avenger, Court Cam Presents Under Oath, which just premiered last night, and Gone Mom. Dan Abrams, welcome to Gervie's Law.
Thank you. It is great to be with you, and there is a lot to talk about.
There is a lot to talk about. I have to tell you, you know, you've had such a prolific career. I don't know how you do it. I know you've dreamt of being like Ted Koppel, but you're like Ted Koppel and Floyd Abrams all in one. How do you have the time?
Well, there's, look, you know, it's about prioritizing, and it's about focusing on the things that I really enjoy doing. I mean, I have to tell you, writing a book, you know, co-writing with my author, David Fisher, takes an enormous amount of time, right? I mean, if you were to say to me, like, you know, in terms of time management, you know, I really need, you know, as you can imagine, many, many hours of uninterrupted work to write the books. And I love it. I love being transported into another time to work on, you know, this book on the trial of Jack Ruby. You know, I learn so much. I really get into it. And so it's about just figuring out, you know, what you love to do.
Why did the trial of Jack Ruby not have more prevalence in our country when the Lee Harvey Oswald, you know, everything that we saw, every movie, everyone was glued to it? What happened with Jack Ruby, and why have people been so excited about Kennedy's Avenger? I read the reviews, and they're really great reviews because people don't know enough about Jack Ruby.
Well, it's kind of amazing, right? Which is, at the time, it was a huge trial, right? In 1964, it was, you know, lead story, New York Times and beyond, even though the trial was in Dallas. So at the time, it was huge because it was effectively the Kennedy assassination trial. What's been kind of amazing is how forgotten the Jack Ruby trial has become. And I say this as someone who didn't know much about it. I mean, when my co-author David Fisher and I were going through what our next book, and this is our fourth book in a series, you know, where we found this forgotten trial that Abraham Lincoln had argued, the last major case he'd argued as a lawyer. And from there, we went to a case where Theodore Roosevelt was the defendant in a case in 1915 that was huge and somehow became forgotten. And then the Boston Massacre trial and John Adams. And we were talking about John Kennedy. And I think I said to him, you know, well, what about Jack Ruby? We both looked at each other. Whatever happened in that case? And, you know, I'm the legal guy. I should know this stuff. And I had no idea, like, the details. And it's just a fascinating case with celebrity lawyers and celebrity witnesses and a jailbreak that occurs during the trial. And so as we got more into Kennedy's Avenger, you know, the more we were thinking, you know, this really has everything that we've been looking for in our next book.
You know, it says in some of these reviews, with journalistic precision and in encyclopedic detail, the authors follow the increasingly complicated and at times ludicrous proceedings from the revolving door defense team to the endless motions and appeals, the conspiracy theories in the course on the ongoing media frenzy. That's from Booklist. Now, that reminds me a little bit about a little trial called O.J. Simpson, where you kind of became well-known and cut your teeth. Why was O.J. Simpson trial so engrossing, and people have to read your book to find out why the Jack Ruby trial was not so far from that?
Well, I think that you know, I think the Jack Ruby, the fact that America watched Jack Ruby live on television shoot Oswald didn't leave a lot of mystery as to who did it, right? And there was no debate during the trial about who did it. It was a question of why and what should be the charge, et cetera. In O.J. Simpson, what made it so astonishing was that, you know, he was claiming he didn't do it and proposing all these alternate theories, as absurd as they were. And yet I think that there's something about that can make a case more, you know, interesting on its face. But what made this case, I think, so important historically, and one of the reasons I'm, again, so surprised it's been forgotten, is that many of the Kennedy conspiracy theories were born out of the Jack Ruby trial, about questions that went unanswered very often during the trial. An objection would happen, or the prosecution would fail to stipulate that Oswald acted alone, et cetera. And I think that led to many of the Kennedy conspiracies, which, by the way, more than half of the American public believes that there was a conspiracy to kill John Kennedy.
Hey, Dan, this is Lauren Woodland. I'm guest hosting the show with Alan, and I'm an attorney. And first of all, I just want to say I've been watching you for years, and I've always enjoyed watching your analysis. And I think you're probably one of the inspirations for me to become a lawyer. So this is just a thrill to be talking to you today.
Thank you. Very nice of you to say.
And she was actress, actually, on Young and the Restless. So what you did was you took a Young and the Restless soap actress and turned her into a Century City lawyer. Not an easy feat.
No. And I'm not sure if that's a good thing or not, but, you know.
Well, I do love the idea of being a legal analyst. Let me ask you this. So in the Jack Ruby trial, he was convicted by the jury, but then that conviction was overturned on appeal. Is that right?
Yeah.
And so exactly. What were the issues? How was that?
So the two main issues on appeal that got, you know, the defense laid out, you know, hundreds of issues. The two issues on appeal that led to the verdict getting overturned were, number one, the judge allowing in testimony of police officers who had talked to Ruby well after he had been in custody. This is right before the Miranda ruling comes out in the Supreme Court. So there was a little ambiguity. It was a little more state to state. And basically, you had to be able to demonstrate that a statement was made as part of what they called the res gestae, meaning the incident itself. So the crime that you know, as it's happening, he makes a statement, you can use that. If you take him into custody and you're holding him and an hour and a half later he makes a statement, then you can't use it in the state of Texas. And so the ruling was that the judge allowed in way too many statements made by Ruby well after the period that would be acceptable. And number two was the fact that the judge did not move the trial out of Dallas. You can imagine what Dallas was like at that time. John F. Kennedy had just been shot. And then 2 days later, Oswald is shot by Ruby. So those were the two main issues.
You know, it's interesting because I don't know if you saw the film Truth is the Only Client, which came out earlier in the year, in 2020, actually. And it went through the Warren Commission and looked at exactly what you're talking about, which were conspiracy theorists and why so many people believed in that. You have to wonder, and we did a whole show on it, and we had the producers and the writers on the show, and they talked about the fact that people wanted to believe what they wanted to believe without evidence. Do you agree with that, or do you think that there really were some evidence that would tend to say conspiracy?
I think that I can understand why there were conspiracy theories, meaning Oswald is a guy who lived in Russia for years, met his wife in Russia, who he brought here, was trying to get to Cuba in the months before Kennedy is shot. You can understand why there are conspiracies. And there were you know, there were a lot of questions that went unanswered, as I said, in the trial. But I will say specifically first with regard to Ruby, none of the evidence of a conspiracy rings true with me. And I'll tell you there are three main reasons that I don't think Ruby could have been involved in a conspiracy. Number one is that 2 days, so Oswald is captured on Friday, and it, you know, it's literally, you know, hours after the shooting of Kennedy. And that night at the police station, Jack Ruby's there, and Oswald is brought out. And if he was hired to be an assassin, you don't wait for another opportunity. You shoot him. You kill him when you got the chance. He doesn't do it. Then 2 days later, on the Sunday, they make this announcement that Oswald is going to be brought out, transferred at 10 a.m. All the media is there, ready to go for the 10 a.m. transfer. Jack Ruby's, you know, basically just leaving his house. He's waking up, and he's going to send a Western Union. He's going to Western Union to send $25 to a woman who works at one of his clubs. He gets the receipt from 11:17 a.m. We're now an hour and 17 minutes after the time that Oswald is supposed to be moved. And he strolls over to the police station, which is down the block. He walks in 30 seconds to a minute before Oswald is moved, and he kills him. So to believe that Ruby planned that timing, you have to believe the police were in on it, too.
Yeah, that's.
You have to believe now that someone in the police department calls him to give him exactly the moment when he walks in, which doesn't make any sense anyway, because why not just go there early and wait for it to happen, et cetera. So those are two. And the third reason is that he didn't have kids, didn't have a family, didn't have a girlfriend, and he had his dogs. And he had his most beloved dog was named Sheba. And he had taken Sheba with him to the Western Union and left Sheba in the car. He left Sheba in the car. Anyone who knows Jack Ruby would tell you if he was going to go plan something like that, he would have arranged for Sheba to have been taken care of and not left in the car.
Yeah. You know, that's compelling evidence. Yeah. You sound like a lawyer. I don't know why you're, you know, a media entrepreneur. What is that all about? You might as well just be in court and argue because you convinced me. Speaking of convince me, we're going to take a break, but I want to talk after the break. And by the way, Kennedy's Avenger is available now. On wherever you get your books, go online and get Kennedy's Avenger. Interesting, interesting book. We're going to talk about Court Cam Presents Under Oath after the break so we can talk about what you expect witnesses to be saying on the stand and why defendants don't take the stand. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC. What happened to Green Day? What is this? Lauren, do you know what this is?
Do not know.
Do not know.
Do not know. Unrecognizable. Sorry.
Rooney, that's the band. Thanks, Art. Art Rooney. Art is our technical guy here, and he's talking about Rooney. You're too young to know who Art Rooney is, but I know Dan Abrams knows. But we're not going to get on a tangent because we're going to talk about Court Cam Presents Under Oath, which is every Wednesday night on A&E Network. It just happened premiere on Wednesday, a day ago, actually. And Dan, it is fascinating. You know, your new show on A&E couldn't have come at a better time. I sat there watching Derek Chauvin on the George Floyd trial thinking, why the heck didn't he get on the stand and speak? Because he was going to get fried anyway, if you want to say it that way, probably deservedly so. But why don't you get a chance? Why didn't someone say, oh, well, actually, maybe he's a nice guy. Maybe he didn't mean it. Maybe he didn't know what was going on. Tell us about Court Cam Presents Under Oath and why defendants don't take the stand.
Well, look, typically defendants don't take the stand for the reason that Derek Chauvin didn't take the witness stand, which is that he would have been destroyed on cross-examination. Why? Because he could talk about how he arrived at the scene. He would claim that everything was innocent, that he had seen George Floyd fighting back, and he'd been very difficult to get in the car. And the problem is, how do you explain minute 4, minute 5? And they say to him, you know, they start taking him through every minute of the video and say, okay, so here we are at 6 minutes and 20 seconds. You've now have your knee, you know, somewhere on the back of his body, and he's now, you know, increasingly not even breathing anymore, et cetera. How do you explain, you know, how do you explain why you're still there and you're still there and you're still there and you're still there? And you know, it would also would have allowed them to question him more about past incidents that he'd been involved in that I think would have been a potential problem for him. And defendants don't take the stand very often because of cross-examination, because their stories often don't make sense or because other information will come in. Now, I'll say that there are occasions, absolutely, we see this in Under Oath on the series, where it definitely helps the defendant take the witness stand. I mean, in cases, for example, of self-defense, you almost have to take the witness stand if you're going to claim self-defense. You have to explain what you say happened. And that's a different kind of situation than a typical murder trial.
Well, in court cam under oath, are we dealing mostly with the defendants who are accused of murder, manslaughter, or these other crimes as well?
It's almost all. In fact, I think all 20, the 20 episodes, I think they're all murder. So it's all murder defendants on the witness stand fighting for their lives.
And do you know whether these are clients who've sort of gone rogue and say, I want to testify, you know, against advice of my counsel, or whether this is something that a decision has been made with client and counsel to testify?
In most of these cases, it's a decision made by client and counsel together. I think there are definitely a couple where the defendant insists on testifying over advice of counsel. And, you know, look, sometimes it pays off. Most of the time it doesn't. But again, what we try and figure out at the end of these shows is, did the defendant's testimony help or hurt? Just because the person was convicted doesn't mean it hurt, right? I mean, it could have been that they got a lesser sentence because some of their testimony was sympathetic or whatever the case may be.
But don't you think for a jury, sometimes silence speaks volumes?
Of course.
So, did you ever do a study? This is fascinating stuff. Did you ever do a study with the cases that you looked at, whether they made it to Court Cam Presents or not? But did you ever do a study to see how many silent defendants who did not testify actually got a better situation, whether acquittal or a less of a sentence than not?
But how do you know what the result would have been otherwise?
That's why you're the brilliant guy, not me.
I'm just saying that there's no way to study it because you can't know for sure what the result would have been otherwise. As you guys know, jurors are sometimes, jurors at the end of a case want to make it clear that they abided by the law, by the rules, et cetera. And so it would be very difficult to sort of do a study based on what jurors say might have happened, could have happened, et cetera.
Well, what about ones who do speak, who do take the stand?
Right.
What is your gut feel with those people?
It depends on what the facts are, right? I mean, so you make a good point, which is if things are so bad for the defendant, you know, we had one guy who just took the stand and described himself as a homicidal maniac. And basically, you know, admitted that he was involved, but wasn't quite admitting he committed the murder. But it was clear he did, and, you know, it was totally clear, and he was convicted, but he didn't get the death penalty. And the jury, I think, you know, he talked about how beaten up he was by the system, by being in prison, et cetera. I think the jury probably felt a level of sympathy, a small level, but rather than executing him, gave him life in prison.
How do you find these cases and these videos? I wondered that with court cam too. Yeah. I mean, how do you find this material?
So I have a network called the Law and Crime Network, which covers trials 24/7. So, you know, we're available on most major OTT platforms, on some cable systems around the country. And so we are constantly getting in live trials. And so a lot of this just comes from our library and our archive saying, oh, this is a great case that not that many people know about. I mean, actually, both the cases that were in last night's episode were cases that were well covered, but not national stories, but are super fascinating. cases that we had covered on the network.
Sometimes I think that might be more interesting to the viewer when they're not that familiar with it. You know, they've seen so much of other cases and they say, wow, this is really intriguing. It's hard to really understand that a lot of this, all the stuff is real, because they think when they're seeing it for the first time that this is something that you dreamt up. Is there any editing or creative license taken in Court Cam Presents?
Well, there's tons of editing, right? I mean, we're telling a half hour or hour episode. Some of them are half hour, some are hour. We're telling the whole story of a case with the defendant's testimony as the central part of the case. So there's definitely editing, and there's definitely editorial.
I mean by creative editing. I mean, everyone can say that you take a stance, whether it's a political stance or not.
Yeah, we're not taking it out of context. We're not, you know, the point is, what we try and do is leave there a level of mystery to the end as to what happens, right? So, and what the jury ultimately decides. We will certainly, you know, what we do is we don't do it in chronological order, right? So we'll start with a little bit of sound from the defendant on the witness stand and then go back a little bit and tell the story some more and then go back to the direct examination followed by the cross, et cetera.
Are you able to use your Abrams Media platform to get all of this out? You know, when you talk, there's so many hands that you have in different cookie jars here. Is there synergy with Court Cam Presents Under Oath and Kennedy's Avenger and sure, you know, some of your other projects?
Sure. I mean, look, I'm doing all sort of big legal stories. And so there's definitely an intersection for so much of this. I mean, so many of the, you know, we produce shows for a lot of networks, and so much of it comes from trials that the Law and Crime Network is getting in that give us ideas. You know, why don't we pitch a show about this? Or why don't we pitch a show, you know, about that? And that certainly helps.
Yeah, I'm sure it would. Now, you know, Lauren's talking about where you're finding all these things. You got Lifetime Network. You got two projects going. One of them is Gone Mom, which is a story that I'm not familiar with. Jennifer Dulos, I guess you pronounce her name, when she went missing and the five kids and the husband was charged. Where did you find that? And tell us about that Lifetime project.
So this is a very high profile case, particularly on the East Coast. It happened in Connecticut. And we both produced the film with Lifetime and also the Behind the Headlines documentary on the story as well. So it's a Saturday night, 2 hours from 8 to 10, and then the documentary from 10 to 11. And this is a story about a woman who disappeared, has five kids, and her husband quickly became the chief suspect. And there was, you know, custody battles going on. And but he was not initially charged with murder. He had a new girlfriend who is also now going to be facing the legal system because he killed himself right before the first murder hearing that he was going to have. And so and insisted he was innocent until the end in the disappearance of his wife. But there is a lot of evidence against him. Surveillance footage of him and possibly his new girlfriend going and disposing. And she may not have known what he had in the bags. We'll see. But disposing likely of Jennifer's body in different dumpsters around Connecticut.
Oh, that's just such a heart-wrenching story. And it seems that that pattern appears a lot, unfortunately. The husband killing the wife, going off with another girlfriend, it's so disturbing. I mean, do you follow up with these families to see what they're – how they're coping?
In the Jennifer Dulos case, we were very, you know, mindful of her family for their five kids too. This just happened in 2019. So we were constantly reaching out to the family representative, to, you know, stay in touch with them throughout the process because, yeah, as you can imagine, very sensitive.
So with this project, it airs on Lifetime?
Airs on Lifetime. Yeah. Saturday at 8 p.m. Eastern, and then the documentary at 10 p.m.
Is it going to be rerun or is it just airing on Saturday?
You know, I'm not sure about the reruns.
Well, I'm sure it will at some point. I mean, there's just so much here. Again, when you look back, and we're going to let you go in a couple minutes because we're going to facing a break. Fact is, you've done so much. What are you most proud of?
That's a good question. You know, I am most proud of probably the combination of my books and the fact that I created effectively a cable network from scratch. I think those are certainly the two things that I think are the things I'm maybe most proud of in terms of what I've done. In addition to, you know, particular stories that I covered that I was, you know, pleased with the way that the coverage ended up coming out. But I think certainly at this point in my life, those two things are the big ones.
And perhaps foreshadowing on The View that Trump will be indicted. Maybe you'll add that to it.
I think this is really just looking at all of the signals that are coming from the DA's office in terms of the grand jury and who they've hired and the fight over the tax returns. And, you know, everything points to, if this weren't Donald Trump, I'd be saying, I would expect that there would likely be an indictment. You just never know when it's the former president.
And is Don Lemon or Megyn Kelly right? Center right, center left?
You know, it's funny that you saw that. Don Lemon called me center right. Megyn Kelly called me center left. I hope that I'm somewhere in the center. You know, I'm the kind of, you know, my politics are the kind of politics that, you know, don't immediately lead to me having a team on my side, on the right or left. And, I talk about this on my radio show all the time, about my politics. I'll do a show one day, celebrating something that Republicans are doing or criticizing something that Democrats are doing, and the next day bash Donald Trump for continuing to tell lies.
You know, so, go ahead. You know, I was going to say that's a great answer, and everyone in this country should hear that answer because maybe that would smarten everyone up and look at some objective ways to make determinations rather than just visceral ones. Dan Abrams, thank you so much for spending time with us today on Gervie's Law. Good luck with Kennedy's Avenger, Court Cam Presents Under Oath, and Gone Mom.
Well, guys, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC. Yeah, we are back. A little harder rock than we were dealing with before. Although, you know, Green Day has kind of that punk feel, even though that's not Green Day. We're getting a little harder as the hour wears on Gervie's Law right here. I'm here with Lauren Woodland. Her law firm is Novian and Novian in Century City. And she is quite a busy attorney. Also, of course, if you listened to the show earlier, you know that she's a well-known actress who grew up acting. And now here you are, Lauren. We have a few minutes left in the show. And I don't often have a chance to do like a rapid round. Just give you a bunch of questions and put you on the spot. Are you up for being on the hot seat?
Great. Sure.
You know, it's funny, as an actress and as a lawyer, obviously you've had to think on your feet in both respects, and especially in soaps. From what I heard, and this isn't part of the rapid round, by the way, but I'm just curious, because I always thought maybe I'd like to be on a soap. I went to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, thought I would be an actor, but I was horrible. It lasted about 6 months. But I thought, if you're not always scripted on a soap and you just see so much going on, how do you deal with that?
Like distractions?
No, just the script. Like you're going from, it's like you're every day you've got new stuff. You don't have time to really, you know, absorb what the lines are.
That's right. And that's why a lot of actors don't like doing soaps, because they have no time to prepare.
Right.
Yeah, you're doing a full 1 hour show every day. Whereas in primetime, you would take 7 to 10 days
exactly.
to do that. Yeah. And you have to do everything in basically 1 to 2 takes. If you can't do that, you're probably not going to work on a soap.
Yeah.
So, you just got to get good at memorizing lines. you know, there are conversations are easier than monologues, right? Because especially if there are cues, if you ask me a question and it's easy for me to remember my line typically, but if I just go off on a tangent or there's some non sequitur, wow. that's harder to
remember.
That's
got to help in your legal practice, I would think.
Yeah, just listening carefully and thinking ahead, and it definitely does help. Yeah.
I mean, you had probably the best training, better than law school, to be able to be a lawyer and do what you do now, because you have to think on your feet.
You do. I mean, judges will ask you questions that even if you're very well prepared, you never even thought of. So, you know, you do have to be ready for that and be confident and speak quickly and clearly.
All right. Here, ready for the rapid round. Here we go. I'll start out with an easy one.
Okay.
What's your favorite animal?
Oh, I guess a dog. Dogs and cats. Horses.
That's too easy. What is a celebrity who you respect? Or who is a celebrity that you respect?
Alan Gervey, that's right.
Oh, wow. No one's ever answered that.
That's right.
That is, first of all, I'm not a celebrity and no reason to respect me, but thank you very much. If you were on a TV show now, what would it be?
Oh, I would love to be on a Ryan Murphy show.
Oh,
I mean,
really?
Any Ryan Murphy show. What he's making is so top notch. The quality is just unbelievable. Everything he does is excellent.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, maybe he's listening and you'll be on one of his shows.
That would be great.
Okay, here's the next question. What's your favorite food?
Everything.
Everything.
God, I love food.
Really?
Yeah, I love everything.
What's your favorite restaurant?
Ooh.
Or one of your favorites. I don't want you to, you know, I'm giving you time to think about it.
Mr. Chow is pretty good.
Oh,
Chow. I like.
Good choice.
God, what's a really fun one on Santa Monica? Italian red leather seats.
Dantana?
Yeah. That's a really fun restaurant.
Oh, yeah. It is. Now that things are opening up a bit, I think we'll be able to enjoy some of those restaurants a little more. Here's another question. What is your biggest regret as you sit here today?
My biggest regret is there was I had a friend, a girlfriend, who was so sweet. She was just a doll, really good-hearted person, and we got in a fight, and that was the end of our friendship.
Really?
It was really my fault. I needed to apologize, and I regret that.
That's, you know, the fact you're saying that is really amazing, because I was thinking about this the other day. When should, and I'm diverting from the wraparound for a second, but when do we have license to end a relationship and when should we try to keep it going? Because sometimes I feel the same way, that I've just been angry or something, gone my separate way, and then I kind of regret it later. And then other times I feel like I am so glad that I am not friends with that person anymore.
Right. Well, if there's a repeat offender, you know, if there's a real problem with trust and they keep lying to you and that just doesn't stop, or, you know, that kind of thing, that's, I think, when you know you have to go. But in this particular situation, it had nothing to do with that. And I just got frustrated for something that really was not her fault.
You're a very big person to admit it. Not many people would do it, and I admire you for that.
Thank you.
Last question before we have to go. We had Dan Abrams on. Tell us what you took from that interview with Dan Abrams. What do you respect, or what was really important to you listening to Dan?
Well, I respect, like we were talking about, how prolific he is. I mean, just the amount of work he's done and continues to do in so many different disciplines. I mean, it's journalism, it's law, it's media, it's so many different things. And to be able to keep all that up and do it well is, I mean, that's very admirable.
You know, it's such a great lesson to think that we can do anything. Not everyone. I mean, there's a lot of people out there that are just totally useless. They can't do anything. But I'm not talking about those people. I'm talking about people who, you know, can focus on things and get so much done. As lawyers, you and I often are inundated, whether it's with emails or with clients, concerns, or with judges or whatever. And you have to be able to be prolific. Maybe not like Dan Abrams, but to be able to have the confidence.
Confidence, absolutely, which you can lose sometimes. One thing happens and it might hit you the wrong way. You got to remember who you are and what you know and what you have to offer. And you also have to learn to manage your stress levels. I think that's huge because certainly in law, you have to know how to do that or you'll burn out.
You know, and Arlene, who's sitting here, thanks for coming. Your publicist, a wonderful publicist.
Arlene Howard.
Arlene yes. Howard is the best. And yep. She said that Dan Abrams has such confidence, and that's what she admires.
That's right.
Lauren, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
It was so much fun. It went by so quickly.
It was so fun. Yes, it did.
All right. You're going to have to tune in next week at Gervie's Law. Same channel, same time. Thanks for listening.